Welcome to the Nerd Party.
Oh, Miles here.
Your Owlpost for the week is freshly delivered, and I am just one of the hosts here, Matthew Rushing, and with me, as she is every single week, in a snuggly blanket, Drea Kaufman.
Hey! Hope y'all can hear me through the blanket.
Yeah, I mean, y'all don't usually need blankets, you know, down there in Phoenix, but man, it's cold everywhere right now.
Yeah, it's a little chilly here. I guess we're getting a nice little winter front coming in, so it's not really worth it to make the house all hot and heatery, so just bundling up instead. But nice. it feels fitting for the chapter we're on, so I'll take it.
Very true. Very true. Mm-hmm. You know, we were on the same wavelength, because I was going to say that. It feels like the perfect time to be talking about a very frosty Christmas. Even though we've already passed Christmas, the weather sure feels like Christmassy. So,
agreed.
Yeah.
Agreed.
Good times. Well, we are on Chapter 16 this week. We're so excited to be back. But make sure you find us wherever you get your podcasts. Owlpost can be had. And make sure you're subscribed wherever you're getting those podcasts, so you can make sure that you get the podcast as soon as it drops. Help us out. If you like the show and you listen, do us a favor. Go over to Apple Podcasts. Give us a star rating review. We read those reviews out on the show as well. So that just really does. It helps the show grow. You probably hear it on every podcast, but it does make a big difference when people are searching for Harry Potter podcasts that we come up. So you can also find us online at Join Nerd Party on Twitter. So make sure you follow us there. Like us on Facebook at facebook.com/TheNerdParty. You can interact with Drea and I there. We post all the shows there, so we love talking to people about what they think about the show. And then last but not least, we're over on thenerdparty.com, where you can go to the contact section and you can send us an email, which we enjoy. Really, we do. We love getting emails from people who are reading along with us and or, you know, interacting with us on Twitter, you know, with the hashtag Owlpost. So all of those places we can be reached. But we can't reach Hermione because, well, right after the last chapter, Harry does not really even get time to say goodbye to her. He, like, barely gets time to say goodbye before they are whisked off to the Burrow for Christmas. And so this chapter starts off with Ron and Harry talking about the revelations that we think we got, that Harry thinks he got with the conversation between Malfoy and Snape. So that's where this chapter begins. And I think it's really interesting because obviously we start at something we didn't actually touch on in the last chapter, but Ron thankfully is going to explain to us what this unbreakable vow is all about that Snape mentioned to Malfoy that he had made to his mother about him and helping him with his project. And so I'm so glad that we actually finally get the answer for what this is.
I mean, we kind of get the answer for what it is. I mean, we get the answer for what an unbreakable vow is, but we don't get an answer for what that unbreakable vow is, because we kind of already have that from the beginning of the book. But we do find out that an unbreakable vow is just that. And I love that Harry kind of goes at it like that too. He's like, man, it's one you can't break. And Harry's like, well, you know what? Believe it or not, I figured that out already.
Yeah.
And so we find out that if you break an unbreakable vow, you die.
Which, you know, I think what not only do we learn here is that this is something that is so serious because this is something the twins tried to do to Ron when he was younger, and his parents walked in on them, you know, trying to do this with Ron. And apparently, well, Fred's left buttock has never been the same, apparently because of the beatdown he got from his dad by doing this. And but I think, you know, it's a very funny way of reminding us and telling us just how serious this is. Like, we kind of got that, obviously, at the beginning of the book. But this just lets us know that whatever Snape, you know, Snape promised to help Malfoy out with this, Draco, with his mission. So if he can't complete this mission or something happens to Draco, Snape is in real trouble because he's dead, y'all.
Yeah. And it's one of those things, too, where it's one of those when you get someone's advice and you want to get a couple people's advice to see kind of how it is mm-hmm. across, right? Like you're kind of garnering your opinions, right? You're polling your people. It's almost like she's doing that here because, you know, you have that beginning where it's really intense and we're taught, made to feel like this is a life or death thing. And then we're like, as you read, you're kind of like, oh, well, maybe it's not quite as dramatic as they've made it out to be. And now we have another side, another opinion with no bias and no reason to tell anything other than the truth, saying it's this dramatic and intense life or death thing. So, you know, it's kind of her way of validating what we kind of already know and really putting it into terms. And I think the fact that she used Mr. Weasley and the fact that Ron describes it as like this was the most Mrs. Weasley that his dad had ever been was like supposed to tell you how actually real this is and how this is not something to toy around with. Especially because I can't imagine what they made him try to do an unbreakable vow in would have been that. I mean, we don't know, but it could have been anything from, right. You know, don't eat our crayons to don't chase the dog. So,
well, and it seems like it's just the act of him trying to do that because this is something that's so, I mean, it's life or death, you know, so it's not something to be played around with, obviously. I also love that as they're talking, they're actually working in the kitchen. They're helping out Mrs. Weasley with, you know, cutting up some vegetables and all this type of stuff. And as they're mentioning things, Fred and George kind of walk in. And there's this whole little scene with Fred and George and Ron and Harry. And they're kind of ribbing Ron about his activities with Lavender Brown and how... You know, he's, you know, basically been getting some action finally. And then Ron asks for help with, you know, doing, you know, the chores that they have magically because Harry and Ron can't do that yet. And they're like, no, I think, you know, you can do that by yourself. And we get this little scene where, like, he ends up throwing knives at his brothers. And his mom sees it and gets really mad at him. And like, this whole scene is just so funny. And I just love the little bits we get here with the Weasley family and, you know, the way that they love each other, but how realistic she is with these brothers and their interaction. And it's funny. It just, I think this book has had some kind of like serious things to it, but there also have been a lot of these moments where we're just getting to spend time with characters. And they do funny things to each other that feel very real, you know, like, I've never thrown a knife at my sister. But you know, I can definitely imagine and remember these type of little picky fights that we would have with each other, you know, that we were getting in trouble for because, you know, we threw an eraser at each other or something like that, you know, so.
I would love to know from someone who comes from a really big family, because I think you're like me, you only have one sibling.
Yeah.
If this is very real for life, and because I imagine it is, I have to believe it is. But most of my close friends and even my husband were all one of two, or one of one, or one of two or three, with big age gaps. So I'd love to hear if this is real for a big family, if this chaos and ridiculousness is accurate. Because I do, I think it feels real. It feels real. But I have nothing to relate it to. So,
yeah. But and I think, you know, maybe that's more important than just that it feels real.
Yeah, that's true.
So, and I think that's one of the things that people like about the Harry Potter books is because there is a realism to them and they feel like, and I don't think people would like them as much if they didn't feel like they could relate. So, yeah, send us your if you've got a big family, you know, and you're listening, let us know what you think. We'd really be interested in that.
Either as parent or child.
Yeah, absolutely.
Either as Ron or as Mrs. Weasley.
We also get in here that Ron and as Ron and Harry talking, Harry reminds Ron, you know, that he told Dumbledore that he wouldn't go off, you know, doing anything because of the, you know, what's going on. And I appreciate that Harry reminds Ron of that. And that he's sticking to it. You know, he's not trying to put the Weasleys in danger, which is wonderful.
Well, it's one of the few times where he's like following that rule too, yeah. Right? Because historically he hasn't really followed that. So this is kind of the first time where Harry's listening to an adult's guidance, which is kind of fun too. It speaks volumes to the relationship that he's built with Dumbledore, but, you know, it's a good little aside that nothing, I think it's also to tell us like nothing crazy is going to happen in this chapter, right?
Yeah, like, this is not like the movie where that stupid scene happens where Dementors strangely
running
attack
out into
for
the
no
field.
Reason.
Yeah.
It's just awful. So no, and not only that, but I think, you know, I was thinking through this, reading the chapter, it's like, I believe that Harry possibly because of what he experienced at the ministry last year, may be a lot more cautious than he used to be, you know, because obviously, too, Dumbledore has put a lot of faith and trust in him, right? With the meetings they're having together, the information that he's getting. And I'm also kind of wondering if, you know, Harry doesn't want to do anything to harm that relationship that he's building. And so anyway, part of it just feels like Harry growing up a little bit. And
well, I also think he because of all that understands what's at stake a little bit more. He has a little bit more of a global perspective on this, right? Like he knows that he's learning more and more about what's going on. And it's not just about one person. It's not just about one thing anymore. Right. I think like you said, he's growing up and coming at everything with just a different understanding. And I think that factors in here too, as to why he's willing to be a little more cautious and heed the guidance a little bit more. So,
well, and I love that their conversation, they talk about, you know, Ron's asking him, are you going to tell Dumbledore this, you know, and everything. He's like, of course I am. And they have this conversation and you're like, Ron's like, well, you know what they're going to say. You know, they're just going to say that Snape's working for the Order, aren't they? And like Harry can hear this whole conversation in his head and like it frustrates him. And honestly, that's going to kind of be the answer he's going to get from everybody he has a conversation with about this. And I think what it does is that even though we think we know these things through Harry, I think the people also that Harry is talking to throughout this chapter bring legitimacy to the fact that possibly we should trust Dumbledore on this.
Yeah, that's an interesting thread, and we'll jump around in the chapter a little bit to get there because I think it just flows nicely right now. But I do think that Lupin's theory is not so much about saying yes or no that Harry's right or wrong. It's taking a different perspective, and instead of saying no, Harry, I don't think he is, or yes, Harry, I think he is, he says, you know what, it doesn't matter. I trust Dumbledore. He comes at it with a completely different perspective, right? And well, Mr. Weasley takes a little bit more of a straightforward, takes the what they expect to happen, which is no, he's acting on orders. He's part of the Phoenix or the Order of the Phoenix. You don't know the whole picture, right? He's acting. And Lupin kind of goes with, yeah, that's probably what he's doing. But honestly, it doesn't really matter because there's more going on than I understand. And I trust the person calling the shots, basically. And that's so interesting because that just speaks to Dumbledore's ability to influence others. It speaks to his ability to gain that sort of followership and instill faith in people, which is such an important skill for someone in Dumbledore's position. And it's something that... it's hard to do. It's intangible, right? And it ends and it kind of bleeds through this whole chapter is this idea that there's now sides and that they have to have faith and be a little soldier-like almost to take orders in the current state of their sort of world right now.
Yeah. Well, and what I think that this does is it speaks to the issue of who are you going to trust? and why are you going to trust them? And there, the fact that in our world specifically, like, everybody likes to be a know-it-all and think that they know everything, right? And that just because they think something, that's what it is, right? And that so that we kind of put ourselves in almost this godlike position of like, oh, well, I think a thing, therefore it has to be the thing. And we forget that there are people that are wiser or smarter or have lived more life and had more experiences and maybe just legitimately know more than us, you know? And Harry, I think, you know, he's showing a little bit of his age here in the sense that he is so wrapped up in what he thinks and his experience that he can't see to the fact that maybe there's more to the story than he knows. And the fact that, you know, Lupin points out for him, he's got these blinders on it when it comes to Snape. And Lupin doesn't discount that, saying, look, James had the same thing. I get it. And I know that you guys kind of have this hate for each other that probably is never going to go away. But you have to be aware that you're not necessarily seeing things as clearly as you possibly could because of that. And you're discounting the fact that the question really is, do you trust Dumbledore or not? It's not whether you're right or not, but it's more along the lines of, do you trust him? And he even says, too, he's like, don't be surprised if Dumbledore isn't surprised about the information you bring to him, you know? And mm-hmm. So, like, you put all that together, and it's a really good lesson for anyone, ourselves and myself included, is just to realize that I don't always have all the answers. And I need to remember that and put myself in a position of always being willing to learn and to grow. And so I think, you know, Harry's just in that frustrating position right now. And part of that is because he's not feeling listened to. But at the same time, he's also not listening. So
mm-hmm. It's a combination of things, too. It's something I think we consistently, a trap or a pitfall we all fall into, too, because if you look at it from Harry's perspective, because I agree with everything you've just said, and when you take it from Harry's perspective, the reason he stays so myopic and the reason he gets so frustrated is because no one is even giving him the opportunity to be right, right? So he may be wrong, he may be right, but no one is playing into
like
that
Billy
idea.
Joel song right there.
No, but no one's like listening to him and making him feel heard. They're just, he's feeling brushed off, right? Lupin kind of comes the closest in terms of kind of explaining his own thought process and sharing some additional light, but nowhere in there does anyone encourage him and say, yes, it's great that you saw this, you know, please share that, I'm glad you shared. Like, nobody is kind of thanking him for what he's done and doing the right thing, which is what they tell him, you know, we've been complaining about since book one. If only they got a teacher, if only they told an adult, right? Here he is doing exactly what we've been complaining about, and then he kind of gets discounted. So, you know, there's kind of a learning lesson on both sides here, both for those who teach Harry how to understand the world and those who are Harry, who are trying to understand the world, right? It's kind of that two-sided thing, like, hey, if you want them to listen and you want them to stay engaged, you have to go at it differently than just telling them they don't know or they don't understand or it's not okay. So I think it's kind of two-sided, and I think we've all been kind of on both sides of it, and been Harry, who thinks they should know more and, you know, is frustrated, and then we've been the parent who's like, oh, you don't know the whole story. I think, you know, we've all been there. So it's just, it's interesting, and it's interesting to see it play out and how the consequences of that can reflect. But I do think this chapter is particularly interesting because we get a really big dose of Lupin that we haven't had since book three.
Yeah, and this is the thing I really liked about this chapter is Lupin being back, and we finally get the answers as to where Lupin has been, which is fascinating.
And why he looks so disheveled.
Yes. Even more so than usual, which is that he has been among his own kind, the werewolves, and he has been working as, you know, undercover for Dumbledore because all of them are basically on Voldemort's side. especially, and this is where we learn about a character that I think we've had reference before, maybe, but this is really where we get the full-on reference for Fenrir Greyback, and we learn who he is and just how bad he is as a werewolf, and honestly, it's just absolutely terrifying. So,
oh my gosh, it's so terrifying. Yeah, I mean, he's in the movies as a very, very tertiary or even further removed character in the movie, and he's not, I mean, he's scary in terms of he's a bad guy, but like if this story were ever described, he would be so much more terrifying. Like, he is the most malicious with this malintent about just, oh, the fact that he essentially wants to breed an, like, as many werewolves that hate wizards as possible. It's just, it's another way she's kind of using racism and classism again in a very mythical way, right? Kind of trying to create this, you know, the superior culture and, you know, overthrow another group of magical beings and to come out on top and to instill fear and hatred of those different. I mean, it's just so awful. So awful. And the fact that he uses kids and his target is children, because then he can raise them in this perspective. It's just, it's awful. It's like, I don't know how to make this any more awful. I honestly don't. I don't know how you can make this any more awful.
I mean,
any ideas?
it sounds like the werewolf version of Hitler Youth. I mean,
yeah.
So
yeah, it's werewolves are Nazis in this book. And you know, the fact that this horrible being is willing to see through his hatred so much because of what has been promised to him by an even eviler person. It's just the weight of everything as we learn more about what's going on just keeps growing and growing.
It's terrifying.
And growing.
It's absolutely terrifying.
It gets scarier
terrifying.
As we learn about it. And I think that's part of why she pieces it out, right? So you get kind of complacent with how things are. And then she drops this bomb of these Nazi werewolves. And you're
Nazi
just
werewolves.
Like, I didn't think it could get worse. We've got evil wizards and giants, and now we have Nazi werewolves. And like,
it's
what is
awful.
Happening?
What I so love too is that this whole like conversation though ends with an amazing laugh in that Harry is talking about how, you know, but you're normal, Lupin. You've just got a problem. And Lupin just burst out laughing because he's like, sometimes you just remind me so much of James, because that's exactly what James called it. Basically, it's my furry little problem, you know, like, and I think this is one of those moments where you just, you kind of remember why you love Harry Potter so much as a character, is because he's somebody who can see beyond people's external, you know, nature to their internal nature. And Harry is somebody who kind of judges people by their heart, right? And so,
yeah, you know, and when we're talking about all that, it's because we learn that Lupin himself was a victim of this terrible werewolf because his dad pissed him off when they were kids, or when he was a kid, which is interesting. And I wish we'd gone into just a little bit more detail of how Lupin did kind of turn out. I don't want to say normal, but in Harry's eyes, normal, right? How did he not hate wizards? How did he become a student at Hogwarts? Like, how did he go through all this if he was subjected to that same attempted brainwashing, right? But we don't get any of that, unfortunately. And we do get Harry's super kind heart. He so can just take an individualistic look at every single person. Dobby and Lupin and Mad-Eye, he just takes this approach to each person individually and kind of assesses them. And sometimes you have like a Malfoy or a Snape where there's some prejudice there and there's some judgment because they're kind of a-holes. But, you know, he doesn't say, oh, you're just a Slytherin, so you're a bad guy. He says, oh, you've been a dick to me for 6 years, so you're kind of a jerk and you're probably a bad guy. So he just has such a unique perspective and really just tries to learn about each person's individual story in life. And that makes him so incredibly unique as a character and as a person in this book.
I don't think it's one of those places where we can actually see her influence from Jane Austen. You know, mm-hmm. a lot of the characters in here either have Pride or Prejudice, and mm-hmm. this book is rife with that. Yeah. This is one of the books, I think, where some of that really comes out to play the most. In fact, it really, I feel like, kind of started in book five, big time, you know, when we had, you know, Dolores Umbridge being there and a lot of those really nasty bits of the undercurrent of the wizarding world and pure bloodness, really. Yep.
Yep.
Mm-hmm. All coming mm-hmm. out. So absolutely, I think it, and that's one of the things I think, there was a book I read about, I think it's called Harry Potter's Bookshelf, and it was fantastic because it was kind of about the literary inspirations for Harry Potter series. And so those things are something that, you know, one of them is definitely, you know, you can see it. Even two with the different characters, you know, like when you look at Ron and Hermione, there's a lot of like Mr. Darcy and Elizabeth Bennet in them, you know? Mm-hmm. And so mm-hmm. I think it's so fun when you can kind of see that, and it's just cool. It's definitely playing out here.
I agree.
Mm-hmm. We also have, I love, before we kind of move off of this section we've been on with Lupin, I also love him explaining how the reason why he doesn't have the same issue with Snape as Harry and his father.
Oh, did. Yeah.
And I thought that was really beautiful because he says, look, he made me the potion perfectly. The year that I was at Hogwarts, he gave me, and he didn't have to do that. But it made my transitions there so much easier because of what he did for me. And I will always be grateful for that. And Harry's like, but he gave away your secret. And he's like, look, it was going to come out anytime. And the way he did it was probably better than, you know, the ways it could have come out in other places. So I thought that was really interesting to see another side of Snape in that sense. When Lupin describes that, you're like, you kind of have to think back to that and be like, dang, he's kind of right. Like that puts it in a new light.
Well, I also think it shows Snape as a dynamic character, right? Because 90% of what we get with Snape is him just kind of being a jerk to Harry, right? Or the people around Harry. He has a few bright, shining moments throughout the series, you know, one where he helps them when at the end of the last book, when he yells, they've got Padfoot in the place where it's kept. Right. He acts upon that. He clearly does good things for the order. And here's a moment where someone can speak to a thing he did that he had no obligation to do, and he did it right. And he makes a point of saying, like, he could have hurt me during this process. He could have done something to cause me much more damage or make things much worse on me, but he didn't. And I think it just shows that Snape's not perfect, right? Like, he's not perfect, but he's also not 100% bad. And I think that's the message he's trying to get through to Harry, is that he may not be great. I'm not going to discount all the terrible things that you've been through, but I have to tell you, you have to look at him as a whole person. And he's not perfect, just like nobody's perfect, right? None of us are perfect. That's part of being human, or in this case, wizard, is that we all have our flaws. And I think we talked a little bit about Pride and Prejudice. I think Snape is his pride, right? And a little bit of prejudice against Harry because of his dad. But I think it's just so interesting that how he explains that. And this whole section of the book is a mix of this super important message that Lupin's given and the most ridiculous things happening at Christmas. Like Ron getting a gold chain from Lavender that says my sweetheart on it. And him spending the entire day saying, there's no way she thinks I'm going to wear this. Why would she think I'm going to wear this, right? To Mrs. Weasley giving everyone a Christmas sweater except Floor, who's just made her irrationally angry this entire chapter. To Floor making fun of Mrs. Weasley's favorite singer on the radio. It's just, it's Christmas. It's Christmas at a big house with a big family. That's exactly what it is. If you've ever had a chaotic Christmas, you're welcome chapter.
Yeah. Well, and we get a little bit more of the conversation, which I think is interesting because as Lupin and Harry are talking, he asks them about this idea of the Half-Blood Prince and if he's ever heard of that. And, you know, Lupin's like, you're taking this Chosen One thing rather seriously, thinking of a new name. And Harry's like, no, I'm just kind of wondering, you know, because it was in this book and, you know, that from Hogwarts and, that I got. And it's part of this textbook and it's got all these spells in it that he's invented, like Levy Corpus and stuff. And we learned from Lupin that that was a spell that was really popular when he was back in school. And he tells, you know, Harry, look, I don't know anybody who's gone by that name. I'm sorry. It was none of us, you know, in my, you know, my friend group. He's like, but did you look at see how old the book is? Maybe that would give you a heads up. And
I like in that part, too, where he kind of reads between the lines of what Harry's asking, because Harry doesn't want to come out and ask what he's kind of afraid to ask, which is, was my dad considering himself the Half-Blood Prince, right? And Lupin sort of reads between the lines and is like, I never heard none of us ever called it that. Your dad never asked us to call him that. Everyone used that spell, right? Like, he instantly knew what Harry was going in on.
Which, yeah. And Lupin is just so great, isn't he?
Like, he's so intuitive.
Yeah, he really is.
But and I do like his tip about checking the age of the book, right? Because if you knew when it was printed, you know about what time it was at school. And I thought that was really interesting. So I also really like that throughout this chapter, Mrs. Weasley keeps kind of bringing up Tonks, right?
Yeah.
All throughout the chapter, because whenever there's Floor, she has to bring up Tonks, because in her mind, she would 1,000% rather have Tonks as her daughter-in-law than Floor, right? And she makes kind of no exception here, and she's not really quiet about it right now, which at the end of the chapter, or nearing the end of the section we're discussing, it kind of prompts Harry to ask questions, and he's like, hey Lupin, you're kind of an expert in this, a Patronus, can it ever change? And Lupin's kind of caught off guard and stumbling over his words a little bit. He's like, yeah, it has to be really traumatic, and you know. And then Harry's sort of like, well, it became like a four-footed creature, and then he's kind of cut off because somebody sees someone else out in the yard.
Well, and it's so crazy because in all of this, like, Harry gets disappointed because he looks at the age of the book and it's like 50 years old. So he's like, well, that wasn't helpful. And then he gets cut off here too from getting to further this conversation, like you're saying, because who's at the window but it's Percy. And
with Percy is
the Minister for Magic himself.
Yeah.
And Weasley, of course, is freaking out because Percy's there, and Percy's like not happy to be there.
Well, and the minister keeps selling it like, oh, we were in the area and Percy insisted on seeing his family. He insisted. And Percy's sort of not really selling it. Like, yeah, we all know that they're not there because
he's not playing around
to see his family, right? Like, it's not working. And Scrimmager makes this sort of half-hearted attempt to cover up his true intent, which is to talk to Harry. And he ends up taking a walk in the garden with Harry, and they have a really interesting conversation that sort of loops back to some of what we were discussing earlier, particularly Dolores Umbridge.
Mm-hmm. Well, and one of the things that we see is that, one, Dolores Umbridge is back at the ministry, which is interesting. We learned that.
Or still at the ministry. I don't know if she ever...
Left. Yeah, I mean, apparently she escaped.
Oh, that's right. She did. She got carried off by centaurs. Yeah.
So,
okay.
And,
go on.
but we learned that Scrimgeour has wanted to meet Harry for the longest time, and Dumbledore has kind of kept him away. And so he's using this opportunity here at Christmas to be able to basically get to Harry. And they have this conversation about whether or not, you know, Harry and Dumbledore have had the conversation about Harry being like the Chosen One and all of, if they've talked through that. And Harry's like, well, that's between us. And then we get the minister saying to him, well, I mean, not that it really matters. And of course, I mean, it'll matter to you, but it's not really important. It's really nothing about what the wizarding community believes at large. It's the perception, isn't it? Is what people believe that's important. And this is what's fascinating to me, because we've fallen into the trap here about that what people put their hope in doesn't really matter as long as they have hope, which is complete BS. Because hope is only as strong as the thing that you put your hope in. So if I put my hope in a rickety chair and I sit on it and I fall on my butt, well, then I'm an idiot, right?
Well, and it's also going to make it harder for you to believe in the future, right?
Yes.
If you put your faith on that rickety chair and you sit down and it crumbles underneath you, the next time you go for it and someone tells you this is a sturdy chair, you're going to think twice before believing them that it's a sturdy chair.
Mm-hmm.
And, you know, it's just something, it's, you know, fool me once, shame on me, fool me twice, or shame on, fool me once, shame on you, fool me twice, shame on me. So, I mean, you also have to be careful, right?
Yep. Well, because too, and this is the thing is that, and this is why people tend to get really like, we don't want to trust government or things like that, is because they tell you one thing to give you hope in it, and then they like it turns out to not be true. It turns out to be something that you cannot trust. And, you know, what Harry is saying here, what he's saying to Harry here is it doesn't really matter. It's just about what people perceive because we want to make it look and like we're strong. And that's the other thing that he asks Harry, which is, hey, wouldn't it be great if you kind of popped in and out of the ministry every once in a while? And, you know, Harry's like, oh, so it can make it seem then like I'm like working with the ministry, like I approve of what the ministry is doing. And he's like, well, yeah, you're pretty quick on the uptake. That would be great.
And then Harry calls him out for all the things. You know, he shows him the parallels between himself and Fudge, who, you know, he basically says you're no better than him. He pretended like there was nothing wrong. And while you're pretending that, while you're not pretending that, you're pretending that you have everything under control and you're strong and making the right decisions, and you're not. So you're no better than he was. And he also calls out Stan Shunpike, who we learned earlier in the chapter was still incarcerated as a Death Eater, even though like there's no chance that he's a Death Eater, right? And in that case, he parallels him to Barty Crouch, who incarcerated people just to give the public persona that things are under control and that things are happening. You know, it's not justice. It's not anything real. And he just calls him out. And I feel like the minister handles it relatively well, right? Doesn't fly off the handle or anything like that. But I think he was taken aback. I don't think he was expecting Harry to be quite as astute or quite as opinionated as he got. Especially not with Dumbledore nowhere around, right? Like if Dumbledore had been there, I think he was expecting a fight like that, but that's not at all.
Well, and that's the thing too, that you're absolutely right. He doesn't expect Harry to basically kind of have any thoughts on this or a mind of his own. And he even tries to like push back on Harry saying, oh, well, you're only 16. And he's like, well, Dumbledore's a lot older than 16 and he don't agree with his either. Like, so the BS you're trying to shovel right now, you can go shovel that somewhere else because I'm not picking up your poop. And I really love that. And like what you said, when he just kind of like goes off, he's like, you're doing the same thing that Barty Crouch did, but in reverse, like the other side of the coin, which is wrong. And it's not helpful for anyone because honestly, the people can't trust the ministry, you know? And he also says, look, I don't remember you jumping to my defense when everybody was saying that Voldemort was back and the ministry was calling me crazy, you know? So I just think it's really fascinating to see Harry be able to pull off not only his experience, what he's gone through, but he's actually, you know, the wisdom from Dumbledore, the wisdom of the others around him, like a Lupin or like Mr. Weasley, you know, a lot of this has stuck with Harry and he's picked up on it. And I think it's really smart. So,
yeah. And the chapter ends on such a very definitive note where the minister tries to sort of insult Harry by demeaning his own opinions by saying, oh, well, you're a Dumbledore guy through and through, huh? Almost making it feel like Harry is a fool for trusting Dumbledore. And he kind of takes it as a compliment and he's like, yep, I'm glad we cleared that up. Are we done now? Like, shall we go back to the house? Like, you know, he does a pretty good job, though, keeping his temper under control, given the circumstances. You know, he gets heated at some point, yep. But for the most part, you know, it even mentions he tries to sort of mirror the minister's level of intensity and attend, you know, in his, he tries to keep things light when the minister's keeping things light. Like, he's really learning to play the game, if you will.
Yeah.
He's.
Well, and what's interesting too is I love right before they talk about him being Dumbledore's man, he says, look, you seem cleverer than Fudge, which is great, but I don't know if you've learned from his mistakes. And he tried to interfere at Hogwarts, and, well, he's not with the Ministry anymore, but Dumbledore's still at Hogwarts. So, you know, just saying.
It's just one of those moments where I think we talk a lot about this chapter showing Harry's age in a lot of areas. And this is kind of an opposite moment where you forget he is only 16, able to kind of hold his own. And this part kind of makes me think of another young adult book, The Hunger Games, whenever Katniss kind of has to confront the president of the Capitol. I imagine that interaction in that book is mirrored a lot off of these instances with Harry. Because of kind of the cool nature and, you know, the youthfulness that comes through, but not the ignorance, right? He's got the fire, but not the stupidity behind it.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, I mean, in the way this chapter ends here with the you know, the straight up, yeah, I'm Dumbledore's man is really interesting. And I think it's fascinating to see Harry still having trouble with the ministry, because at the beginning of the book, where you got the feeling, or maybe you hoped, I think, and I know the first time that I read this, I kind of got the hope that this would be a different minister, and that would mean maybe they would be more supportive of Harry, and for a while they kind of seem like that, but now what we see is that they're just the opposite side of the coin from Fudge, and that's not making them any better. And I think, you know, Harry rightly just calls out to them saying, look, you taking action where Fudge took no action is not helping because you're still taking the wrong action.
Well, it's not just that. They're not even necessarily taking action. It's they're trying to create the perception of taking action, right? So while he thought there might be some bark behind that bite, he's still just seeing the bite, right? Like I think I said that wrong, but whatever, y'all can correct me. He was hoping there was something behind the persona that they're putting forth, but it's still just a faulty front. And he's still seeing the fact that they're not actually doing the right thing here. They're just trying to make everyone think they are, and that will be enough. So in that case, they're not really working against them, but they're not really working with them either.
Well, it's because we're not basing this on any true action. We're basing this on false action. We're basing this on action that really amounts to lies from the ministry. Saying,
the
we're doing things,
meant to keep up.
Yeah, we're keeping up appearances.
Yeah, the action's meant to keep up the persona, right? Not meant to actually do anything.
Yeah. So, and I think I just love the way this chapter is so relevant. You know, when we're talking about this, I mean, it's, you know, Rowling has really dipped into something here that is, it has been a problem, you know, from time immemorium, since governments have begun, you know, of these type of things happening. It's part of I think, our wicked human nature to want to do these type of things where we especially when we gain too much power, we want to keep it. And so I think it's fascinating.
It's a fatal flaw of any system that has you choose a leader based on popularity, right? They're going to tell you what you want to hear because they want you to like them, not because, you know, sometimes hearing the truth is hard to do. And if you don't trust them and you don't know them and that's not what you want, I mean, for him to stay in office, he has to look like he's taking action, right? And what politician goes, you know what, I don't care if I keep my office, I'm just going to do the right thing. Those are the ones at the end of their careers, or the ones that only get one term or no term. So It's sad to say, and that shouldn't be the way it is, but that's just the flaw to the system we've created, that there's not enough checks and balances and holding people accountable to their word. And this is, again, just more highlighting her sort of bitter diatribe about government and media, right? They tell you what you want to know, not necessarily what you need to hear or know.
Yeah. Yeah. Crafting a narrative, whether it's true or not, is as long as it fits their desired outcome is really all that matters. And yeah. Yep. Yeah. So yeah, we don't have to look too far to see that every single day. Just turn on any news channel you want or any podcast for the most part, except for this one, Twitter.
Want you to love Harry Potter. So yeah, we are kind of controlling the narrative a little bit by telling you why you should love Harry Potter.
This is true.
But we're not lying to you. You should love Harry Potter.
It is absolutely true. So, but that's the end of the chapter. We'll be back next week. Really excited. But Drea, where can everybody find you if they want to catch up with you while we wait for the next chapter?
Sure. You can find me on Twitter at PCFChick or on Instagram at Drea Kaufman, and it's COFFMAN.
And you can find me Twitter, Instagram, Letterboxd, and Vero named MattRushing02 on all of those places. You can find me here on the network with Aggressive Negotiations. John Mills and I talk about Star Wars each and every week. So if you like the Star Wars saga, it's a place for you. I'm over on the Trek FM network doing two shows. When I get a chance, when we get a chance, Chris Jones and I talk about Star Trek Deep Space Nine and The Orb. I do the General Geek Show, the 602 Club, where we talk about all of the fandoms that we love, not just one. And you can find me doing cinema stories, my good friend Courtney talking about films, but through the lens of faith. So thank you so much for checking your outpost.
It's just managed.
Join the revolution. Join the Nerd Party.